Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest. For August 4th, 2022, it's the Nothing's the Matter with Kansas edition. I am David Plotz. I'm here in Washington, D.C. Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine and Yale University Law School joins us from a wooden shack somewhere in northern New England. Hello, Emily.
Hey.
And John is out. I think he's going to be out for a couple of weeks. And that means we have a chance to have a great new guest host making her full hosting debut from The Sum of Us, the book, and The Sum of Us, the podcast. The Gabfest welcomes Heather McGee. Heather, it's great to have you back on the show.
Oh, it's so fun. I'm so excited.
This week on the Gabfest, Tuesday's wild and divergent election results. Kansas voters stand up for abortion rights. Missouri voters reject a monster. Arizona and Michigan Republicans put election deniers on their November ballots. Then the horrors of the Alex Jones trial and whether he can be punished enough or even at all for his sins. And then we'll talk to The Atlantic's Annie Lowrey about her grueling and disturbing and profound account of her life-threatening pregnancies. Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter. For Tuesday night in August, the election results were really wild. Kansas voters protected the abortion rights enshrined in the state constitution, according to the Kansas Supreme Court, enshrined in the state constitution, with extraordinary turnout in a midterm primary election and huge support for the vote, even in Trumpy areas. Arizona nominated a bunch of extremists, a Senate candidate named Blake Masters, a Secretary of State candidate, Mark Finchem, who is a true 2020 election denier, deeply troublesome person. Missouri Republicans, on the other hand, rejected the lizard in human form, Eric Greitens, who was credibly accused of all kinds of abusive behavior towards women, but nominated someone who's much more likely to hold that Senate seat for the Republicans. Michigan Republicans nominated their most electable candidate for governor and tossed a House member who had voted for Trump's impeachment. So, Emily, let us start with the Kansas vote, which was pretty astonishing. What does it suggest about how the Dobbs era and the horrifying stories that the Dobbs era has already given us will shape up politically?
Yeah, I mean, I confess I was very surprised by this vote. I had simply looked at the fact that there were twice as many registered Republicans in Kansas as Democrats and assumed that this measure would pass. And a couple interesting things. The measure did not ban abortion. It returned abortion to the legislature for a possible ban or other restrictions. And Kansas actually allows abortion all the way up until 22 weeks. So the fact that the voters were so overwhelmingly in favor of keeping the status quo was really interesting. And, you know, the side that was fighting against this amendment really emphasized some of the kind of libertarian small government values of Kansas. And I think that was smart. When you look outside of Kansas for what this means nationally, I mean, one obvious lesson is that if you put this issue directly to the voters and there's nothing else on the ballot, in other words, they're not judging a candidate with all the aspects of being a Republican or a Democrat, you're just looking at abortion, it seems likely that in other states as well, this is going to be a loser for abortion opponents. The ACLU did some polling in Mississippi, which suggested that maintaining abortion rights is more popular than certainly I would have expected. And so, you know, I think what we're seeing here is a kind of vulnerability for abortion opponents, this question of whether they have gone or about to go too far. But how it translates into races where, you know, also inflation is on the ballot and all the vulnerabilities for the Democrats, I just don't think we know the answer to that yet. I'm curious, Heather, what you think about that.
You know, I think that this has always been the Supreme Court case. Dobbs has always been the result of a 50-year plan to do something that was highly unpopular, right? And we have to remember that. It's really difficult when we have both, you know, a huge majority on the Supreme Court and a lot of Republican legislatures across the country at the state level to remember that our democracy has a lot more of the things that are antithetical to today's far right being overwhelmingly popular across the country, right? You know, abortion is something that one out of every four women has. The idea of the kinds of hacks that we see in state legislatures deciding whether or not my family, how my family is going to expand or not, is just crazy to many people. Mississippi, that polling, Emily, that you noted, you didn't need to see the ACLU poll because you could go back in time and remember when Mississippians overwhelmingly rejected a personhood amendment, right? That would say that give constitutional personhood rights to, anything growing in a person's body, right? And so I think it's really important for people who are supportive of reproductive freedom to use this Kansas moment to pick themselves back up and say, you know what, they're on the wrong side of history, they're on the wrong side of the people, and we can't be timid about defending this essential human right.
But there's a gap between the popular question is, are abortion rights, do people want them, and should they be protected, and the practical ability of people to do that. Kansas allowed it. Kansas, because of the structure, what the Kansas Supreme Court had done already to protect abortion rights, there was this possibility of a clear referendum, and it was well timed, certainly for supporters of reproductive freedom. But are we going to be able to see in other states this kind of popular measure? I think the point you started with, Heather, about these Republican state legislatures is so important, that in so many states we have state legislatures which have super majorities of Republicans, very conservative Republicans, and Republican governors. And the chances that we're going to see ballot measures and other efforts that enshrine abortion rights seems to me pretty low in most of these states.
I think that's right. I think this is going to be a long, hard slog to get back to some sort of fairness and dignity. And in the meantime, pregnant people are going to die. But this is really where, we have so many issues that are on the ballot in various states. We have so many issues that candidates stand up for. And most of them, many Americans feel like, it doesn't really matter, right? What politicians say or do, you're kind of all the same. It's not really going to affect my life. This is one of those moments where, when it really comes down in your life as a voter, as a member of a family, and you realize that some law that somebody made is fundamentally changing, imperiling your life, making it harder for you to feed the children you currently have, it is galvanizing, right? We've seen huge upticks of voter registration, particularly among women, in the wake of Dobbs. And so you're right that the machinery of a, not that representative democracy has always been on the side of patriarchy and always on the side of men using the state to control women's bodies. But I'm very wary as someone who talks about politics in the public, to seem like this is, like there's no hope. And the people that I've talked to who are on the ground helping pregnant people move across state lines, they haven't lost hope, right? They're like literally threatened with violence and with incarceration, and they haven't lost hope. So I just think it's really important to take this moment of this win. And do we have to fix our democracy? Do state legislatures have to change to be more representative? Absolutely. And I think that's where, frankly, Democrats should be and should have been spending a lot more time focusing.
Moving to some of the other results. So as a citizen, I feel a sense of relief that Republicans rejected the most grotesque man in politics, Eric Greitens, in the Missouri Senate race, although it does mean that a very conservative Republican is likely to win that seat. But still, a number of pretty frightening people won on Tuesday, Heather, including Mark Fincham, a full-on election denier who could be the next Secretary of State in Arizona, administer the state's elections, Carrie Lake, who could be the governor of Arizona. What does it mean that there are election deniers and election meddlers up and down Republican tickets in Arizona, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania?
Honestly, it's one of the things I'm most worried about in terms of the short-term dangers and threats to our democracy. We've got a bunch of billionaires and a bunch of big liars and a bunch of billionaire-backed big liars. We've got some people who are really, really espousing a pretty terrifying vision of the country that makes Trump look like a Sesame Street character, Masters, the Senate nominee, who's backed by his best friend, Peter Thiel, has a really scary vision of the world. And it's one in which it's not just, oh, I'm just a far right libertarian. It's like, actually, I'm so worried about the, you know, saving my country that I think what we really need is huge government that is taken over by a few smart men who can stop, who can use any means necessary to stop the threat of the radical left. And this is not a House candidate. This is not, you know, a state legislative candidate. This is a U.S. Senate candidate. And it's really scary. Like, it's this combining of an anti-democratic with, you know, not at all afraid of a concentration of wealth and power with a lot of patriarchy and racism and xenophobia. And he's like wrapped up in a very sort of physically appealing, you know, nondescript package. And that's what we've really got to be worried about, is that the internet, frankly, has mainstreamed and created communities for ideas that most Americans, you know, at least for now, would think are totally abhorrent. But, you know, add a few billionaires behind you, and you can make it all the way to governing power.
Emily, what do you make of this defeat of Peter Meyer, a relatively moderate Republican who had voted for Trump's impeachment in Michigan, a extremely Trumpy, very conservative guy named John Gibbs, who is kind of came out of nowhere to beat Meyer in a Republican primary in Michigan, in part because Democrats spent a bunch of money to help Gibbs beat Meyer in the hopes that running against Gibbs would make it easier to elect a Democrat in that district. It's also a bet that Democrats made in Pennsylvania, where they ran ads to help Doug Mastriano, another real piece of work, become the Republican governor gubernatorial candidate there. Should Democrats be meddling in these Republican primaries to help these Trumpier candidates, number one? And number two, is it worth us wasting any time blaming them for doing that when, of course, it's Republican primary voters who are the ones casting the ballot? So Democrats are not really responsible for John Gibbs getting the nomination.
I mean, to me, it just seems like such a high-risk strategy. And there is something just odd about coming in behind the candidate that Democrats, you know, would vehemently oppose if they won the primary, which is now, of course, what's going to happen. And I think you also risk confusing voters. It just seems like a kind of, I mean, it's obviously, you could argue that there's like sophisticated strategy here that Mitch McConnell would totally approve. Like, it's gaming the race in the way that gives the Democratic challenger the best chance of winning the actual election. And I think if Democrats run the table on these races, then they're going to be able to say this was a smart strategy. But there's something distasteful about it. And I don't know, maybe I sound naive saying that, but the high risk nature of it, the sort of moral ambiguity of it, bothers me.
Yeah, I don't think we can say in the same breath that election deniers are a threat to our democracy and here's $500,000. Democrats keep running on like Republican boogeymen, and I understand Republicans keep creating those boogeymen, right? It's not Democrats' fault that the right wing has taken over the Republican Party. But it feels like a huge part of the problem in the Democratic community right now, in the Democratic voter base, is a lack of enthusiasm for our people. It's not that we don't understand how scary the bad guys are. It's a lack of enthusiasm for Democrats and a lack of commitment from Democrats to delivering on what many, you know, Democratic activists left it all on the field for, which was a Democratic trifecta in Washington, and feeling like there's something about the party spending hard-earned money of people who were, you know, responding to those obnoxious texts and sending it to scary Republicans instead of, you know, working twice as hard to put that money into flipping a seat and expanding the majority with, you know, real Democrats who are willing to fight for the Democratic agenda.
Slate Plus members, you get bonus segments on the Gabfest and other Slate podcasts and member exclusive episodes on some shows like Slow Burn and Amicus, and you'd also get no ads on our podcast. If you go to slate.com/GabFest+, you can become a member today. We'll talk about whether it is remotely possible, as Heather, I think, thinks it is, to be optimistic about America anymore. So become a Slate Plus member today by going to slate.com/GabFest+. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
The judgment phase in the first of three Alex Jones defamation trials is wrapped up, and then we're waiting for the jury to make a decision. But it was comical and terrifying. On Wednesday, it took a real turn when lawyers for the Sandy Hook families who had won a defamation judgment against Jones, they won it basically because he refused to defend himself. He didn't even show up. They revealed that Jones's lawyers had handed over everything on his phone to them by accident, which allowed them to prove that Jones had wildly perjured himself in denying that he had discussed Sandy Hook or that he even used email. They're seeking $150 million in damages from Jones and his affiliated companies, InfoWar companies. There are also these other two trials, I think, which are going to do the same. So, Emily, start by reminding us what Alex Jones did in this case that is so despicable. I'm a great lover of the First Amendment, but what Alex Jones has done in the name of the First Amendment is truly sickening.
Yeah, so these are families who lost their children to the Sandy Hook school mass shooting. And Alex Jones relentlessly called this a false flag operation and accused the parents of lying. A lot of the allegations at this trial have to do with a television special that Megyn Kelly taped with one of the fathers here. And afterward, Jones implied that he had lied about his own son. And one of the things I think that makes Jones's speech so problematic and to me very much justifies this defamation suit is the terrible cost to these families where people believed Jones and there was a lot of bullying and harassment and intimidation and, you know, threat that they have faced for years. It has dogged them. And so they really have borne a cost. Jones, meanwhile, we know is making just tons of money with all the supplements and body armor and other stuff that gets sold on his show and advertisements, you know, figures like $50 million a year that he is pulling in. And so then when you look at this $150 million demand for damages that the families have put forward, what you're talking about is two things, the actual harm that they have suffered, and then also being able to really send a message to Jones and really make him actually pay. I mean, if this ends up being a small award, it's not clear how much it's really going to matter to him. He could make the calculation, sure, I'll do this again because, you know, chances are I'll get to keep most of it the next time. He has gone into bankruptcy proceedings, but that's really probably a way of kind of protecting his assets and trying to make sure he doesn't have to pay or pays as little as possible. And then the other thing that's just been remarkable about this trial are the revelations you were talking about, where it seems clear that he did not turn over evidence he had that would have helped the families prove their case. And then also he has been going after them and the judge and the jury on his show, you know, up to date. And so there is also this sense that, you know, everything he touches gets smeared. And you got to wonder whether the jury is going to be taking that into account.
Heather, in any decent society, Alex Jones, people like Alex Jones would be anathema. They would be shunned. They would be unable to walk into a room without being hissed at. They would be working at marginal jobs, certainly not have a platform. What is it that has changed in the world, and I have a theory about this, that allows someone so without decency to thrive? Why is it possible to monetize this kind of craziness and draw people to you with this kind of craziness in a way that it was much harder to do a generation ago? Not that there weren't crazy and antisocial and lying people, but that they couldn't do what Alex Jones has done.
You know, there's a really interesting dad, one of the many dads of these slain babies, who the kid's name was Noah, the dad's last name is Posner. And he is a very interesting character to look at in this, trying to figure this out, because he's like, I used to listen to Alex Jones on the radio on my way to work, you know? Like, why is everybody acting like this is a fringe figure? Like, I have questions. I'm skeptical. I'm skeptical of the government. I'm skeptical of corporate media. You know, he really does play on a widely held skepticism of big institutions, the sense that, you know, people with a lot of power are lying to you. And so there is something that he's very good at, Alex Jones, which is basically saying, you know, other powerful people are lying to you, and I'm the only one with the guts to question these things. And if you follow me down this rabbit hole, you'll be smarter. You'll be in a community of people who really know what's going on. You will have a sense of purpose in your life. And, you know, the problem, the danger of that is that many people take that sense of purpose and then terrorize these grieving families, right? The guy Posner I was talking about has had to move a dozen times. He's in hiding. He collects his mail through post office boxes. Like, what are we talking about here? So I think it's important not to marginalize Alex Jones, you know, who's at his peak had like 1.5 million views a day on across his various platforms and accounts, but also recognize the role that big tech, which absolutely has a financial incentive for this kind of outrage, because if you're down a rabbit hole, you are refreshing pages, you are clicking, right? You are in it, you are addicted, you can't stop. And that's how they make their money. And then our lack of any kind of media regulation or accountability for this damaging activity.
David, what's your theory for why we have such a, you know, prominent, like, looming figure here instead of someone who should be in his basement with nobody listening to him?
Well, it is really the way in which the internet allows people to gather, and that you can. That a figure like Alex Jones, a generation ago, might have 100 subscribers to his newsletter, to his fringe newspaper, but that when a platform, and he was enabled by the big platforms, he's off the big platforms now, but at the beginning he was able to gather his tribe around him on the big platforms. When you can collect all those people together, you are no longer marginal. When you're, it's not that people weren't susceptible to these beliefs a generation ago. It's not that people didn't hold these beliefs a generation ago. It's not that they didn't have these suspicions of big institutions a generation ago. It's not that people weren't conspiracy minded a generation ago. It's that when the platforms can allow all these people to get together, those people are monetizable and they are motivatable in groups to do awful things to other people. And so it really is a function of what the internet and specifically what the big platforms allowed early on.
But I think your point about how the platforms allowed Jones's prominence and then stepped in too late is a really big dilemma for the platforms, because how do you know who the nascent Alex Jones is, as opposed to like, well, we're just allowing a lot of speech and a lot of dissent and we need skeptics and people asking questions. Like, deciding where that line is a genuinely tricky problem for any kind of free speech platform and for democratic communications. It just seems pretty clear right now that we are in a situation in which lies and misinformation are warping our democracy and making it very hard to have a kind of shared consensus around facts. And Jones is very much a part of it. I mean, it's no accident that he was also involved in planning, it appears, the January 6th riots and was like caught up in all of that. So just this difficult questions. But I don't find this defamation suit to be a difficult question. I think it's really important that these families are protecting their reputations and trying to hit back here.
You know, Emily, it raises for me the mini trend. I wouldn't say, you know, I can be really hopeful about it, but as I think about a couple of different places where big corporations are being held accountable for the real life harms, one in the disinformation space, right? When we looked at all the right-wing media that peddled the lies about the election, and we've got this like Titan clash with a huge election technology and voting machines company, Dominion, throwing $1.5 billion lawsuits at, you know, Fox and the Murdochs specifically, OAN and Newsmax, basically saying, you know, you defamed us and you amplified these false claims and it cost us. And it's really, for me, as someone who, you know, has been very worried about the impact of these media outlets on our democracy, on, you know, our multiracial democracy, on the ability to create some sense that we're all in it together, to have the corporation with the deep enough pockets actually be the ones to say, you know what, we're going to make hold you to task for this, and the lawsuits are going forward, is really huge. And I think that it's one of the things that seems like there has been sort of a crescendo of alarm about disinformation across the globe. And I think we're going to see more of these kinds of lawsuits by the people who and corporations that actually have the money to take them, right? I keep thinking about the Sandy Hook families and how this has drained their wealth and their time and everything. And so I'd rather see a huge corporation have to do this than grieving families.
Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
Welcome back to the GabFest. Annie Lowry of The Atlantic. Annie wrote the article that was most passed around the internet this week, at least my corner of the internet. American motherhood. My pregnancies could have killed me, but at least I chose them. It is a stunning and grueling article. Whatever horror you have imagined for yourself, I can assure you that it is not as bad as Annie's description of just one miserable aspect of her pregnancy. So Annie, can you start by telling us what happened in your pregnancies and why you wanted to write about them now?
My pregnancies were physically debilitating, and it was mysterious at the time until about midway through the second pregnancy why that was going on. And it turns out that I have a rare degenerative liver condition that does not play well with pregnancy. So something about 100,000 or 150,000 Americans have this condition, and it's almost always diagnosed in people who are 40, 50, 60, so somewhat older than most people when they're having kids. But the hormone load of pregnancy combined with this creates these kind of debilitating symptoms. So this itching that they cannot do anything for. So I itched basically the entire time I was pregnant, both times, all over my body, like I had poison ivy and they just can't do anything for it. And then I had just a lot of other complications, some of which it turned out that I actually have a second permanent condition, which is that I have type 1 diabetes or juvenile diabetes. I was diagnosed as an adult shortly after my second pregnancy. They realized that I had that. But, you know, I had really bad preeclampsia. I had a placental abruption, which is a really, really dangerous complication of preeclampsia. I had really, really traumatic deliveries, which I think is, you know, in the first case, my son was born preterm. In the second case, it was just kind of happenstance that it was an unfortunate delivery. And, you know, the reason I wanted to write the article was that, you know, only for a brief period of time were these conditions obviously life-threatening, but they were absolutely threatening to my health the entire time. And I'm not sure that I would qualify for termination for medical reasons in the states that are now really aggressively banning abortion. But, you know, I've also been told not to be pregnant again. And so, you know, it's just my one story, but there are thousands, you know, 3.5 million people a year give birth in this country. There's going to be many, 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 many more stories like this where it's not obvious that somebody's life is in danger, but it is.
Annie, I really want to thank you for the article. It was devastating and funny and so immediate. I don't think you have to have had been pregnant as I have or given birth as I have to feel the sort of terror. There's one line that I want to read because I want to make sure that people reading, listening to this who haven't read the piece yet don't think like, oh, like itching, that doesn't sound so bad. But that's based on this underlying chronic disease that's rather rare. But your traumatic deliveries, like that's not rare, right? And I'm speaking as a Black woman, right? Where, you know, we have incredible stories and statistics of trauma and lack of care in our maternal health. So I just want to read a couple lines. A request from the doctor for more anesthesia, a warning that it would take a few minutes to kick in. Searing pain leading me to scream at the doctor to stop. The doctor with the forceps not stopping. Nurses pinning my legs down in the stirrups. The sense of being eviscerated, the room going technicolor. I did not know I could feel so much pain. Like, my heart is racing right now. Right. I mean, it's just, this is not to say that we won't continue to get pregnant and have children and do these sacrifices, but it is to say that the fact that this radical minority on the Supreme Court did not take any curiosity into what it really is to be pregnant and to give birth, means that we just were rendered invisible. And I think that that is a really powerful theme in your piece, which is just that, you know, the balancing was always supposed to be between the mother and the life and the mother and the fetus, as if the mother is not doing that balancing every single day with every waking breath. But this court got it so phenomenally wrong, and people will die because of it. And I wonder what the reaction has been to the piece in the, you know, less than a week, I think, that it's been out.
To pick on a really important point there, you know, the court has basically asked all of these questions and left them unanswered. If you've experienced birth trauma, should you be forced to continue another pregnancy when you don't want to be pregnant? If you have mental health conditions, if you are experiencing suicidal ideation, should you have to continue your pregnancy? These are the kinds of questions that are going to come up again and again. And I do, you know, I was a college-educated white woman with a husband who argues for a living when I was undergoing this entire process. And so I thought often about, you know, if I didn't have the same confidence in the medical system, if I didn't have the same set of privileges that I had, would this have gone differently for me? You know, would my older son be alive? Would I still be here? And I think that that's, you know, especially a question that might be on the minds of Black women when one in 1,800 dies having a child in this country. And I think it's such an important point. You know, one question I also have is for this, you know, pocket of terminations for medical reasons that's going to happen in states where abortion is banned, who's going to get those? How sick do they have to be? Are those going to be, quote unquote, like fairly distributed? Of course they're not. And, you know, I'm very interested to see the disparate impact on racial terms. And so, you know, the response to the piece has been amazing. And it's in part come from people who've shared their miserable, terrifying experiences giving birth, since, you know, complications, many people give birth safely and have safe pregnancies. And, you know, a lot of people even, I can't understand this, but they enjoy the process and that's great. But it's really common to have even very serious, and in some cases, life-threatening complications. And so, you know, it's been interesting seeing so many people be like, you know, this happened to me and this was horrible and I can't imagine having another kid or being forced to. And then there's been, you know, I'm sure as you both would expect, you know, like a fair number of people being like, well, you're killing babies. And how could you argue for that? And there's been a lot of, you know, like biblically women are meant to suffer, which I don't quite know what to do with. Yeah, I'm not sure how to think about that. And, you know, it's something that there's been so many of these stories over the years, and doctors have said this over and over and over again, abortion is healthcare. And now we're really finding that out in an even more acute way than was already true. When you could terminate for medical reasons up to the point of viability, thanks to Roe and Casey.
Annie, one last question. I want to take us to a different piece of yours that was also really great that I was reading. Can you talk about the Turnaway study? What that is and why it is so important in this moment.
The Turnaway study is amazing, and it was conducted over a long period of time by a set of researchers who essentially recruited pregnant people in the waiting rooms of abortion providers, so mostly clinics in states across the country. And some of those folks arrived at the clinic in time to meet their state's, you know, gestational limit and received a termination. And some wanted a termination and didn't make it in time. And so what that allowed these researchers, this was run through UCSF, to do was to compare people who got an abortion versus people who wanted abortion and didn't get one. And so it was almost like a natural, like randomized study so that you could compare these two populations that were unbelievably similar and see what effect you could isolate the effect that the abortion had on the person's life. And what they found was that, you know, as expected, carrying to term was much more dangerous than having a wanted termination. So nobody died in the sample of people who received an abortion. Two women died from complications of pregnancy who wanted an abortion and didn't get one and had to carry to term. And then there were all of these other effects, mental health effects, financial effects, effects on, you know, most people who have an abortion already have a child or children. And the children of people who got the abortion when they wanted one met more milestones and were doing better than the kids of people who wanted an abortion and didn't have one. There's all sorts of heartbreaking details in there about what happens to people who wanted an abortion and ended up giving up a child for adoption, which was just brutalizing to the people who did it and very upsetting to them. And it, you know, one of the great takeaways I thought from this study was that a lot of, you know, folks' fears about carrying to term when they don't want to were very much borne out in it. It really affects your life. It affects your health. It affects your body. It affects your other kids. It affects your romantic relationships. You know, if you got your wanted termination, you were much likelier to be in a happy romantic relationship later on, a stable romantic relationship. You were less likely to be with a partner who was abusing you. And I think it's the best study that we have that shows the wide-ranging effects that abortion access has on the lives of women and other people who bear children.
Annie Lowrey wrote American Motherhood for The Atlantic this week. Check it out. Thanks, Annie. Let's go to cocktail chatter. When you, Emily, are sitting surrounded by black flies and mosquitoes on some unscreened-in porch in rural New England, what are you going to be chattering to your beloveds about?
So I am part of launching this week a new journalism training project. It's called the Law and Justice Journalism Project. And the idea is to bring together veteran journalists and producers and editors and people who are experts on the criminal legal system to improve reporting on issues related to justice and public safety. And this is obviously a longstanding interest of mine and this increasingly pressing issue about how issues of crime and justice are disseminated by the media and what effect they have on the electorate and how to do it well without fear-mongering. This is really hard stuff to cover. And so this project has two components. One is a bunch of panels that's open to anyone who wants to come. So we're hoping reporters, you know, anybody will find some of them helpful and they'll be like real skills building kind of panels. And the second part is a mentorship program pairing early career journalists, especially local journalists in both print and broadcast, with veteran reporters. And these veteran reporters and editors will help the people they're paired with think through the challenges they're confronting all through the course of the year. So we have funding for this for the up-and-coming journalists who participate, and we're hoping that you'll apply. So big shout out to people who are interested in these issues and improving and thinking through their reporting on them. It's a pretty simple application process, and you can find it at the website for Law and Justice Journalism Project, or you can follow this project at LJJ Project on Twitter.
That's so cool, Emily. I love that.
Heather, what's your chatter?
I'm going to take us from highbrow to very lowbrow. So I've been just slammed lately. I'm teaching at CUNY. I'm, you know, promoting the book and giving speeches. And then I've been on the road almost every week for the past 6 months, recording the podcast that we're going to talk about later, The Sum of Us, going all around the country. I'm like flying too much. My back, I have a pinched nerve. It's just been a mess. And I found an escape. And it has been a really beautiful thing. I had stopped reading fiction because I was reading so much nonfiction, so much news. I was researching the book and everything. And I just, you know, it was kind of not what I did. Instead, I would, you know, watch TV with my husband or something like that. But I rediscovered the love of, like, basically the kind of cotton candy that I wanted in TV in what is called a book. And it's really interesting. And this is actually what I would talk about at a cocktail party, because I think it's important to remind people that
I think people at cocktail parties have heard a book. Be like, have you heard about books?
No, but I'm going to tell you about this book that I'm sure cocktail parties are not talking about right now. It is a fantasy, like, double trilogy called A Court of Thorns and Roses, and it's by this, like, 20-year-old. I think she's like 35, but she started writing when she was like 29. Sarah Moss. It's like a huge bestseller, but, you know, only in a world in which you're reading, you know, romantic fantasy novels. And I have found myself like staying up till 2 a.m. reading. And I just want to put a shout out into the world for reading things that are really transporting and that totally change your mood and like your body and your just feeling of the world. Because there's something about TV that, I don't know, when it like it's decision overload, right? Like, oh my God, you know, I make enough decisions in the day. I don't want to sit down and be like, what do I need to watch across all these different platforms? And then there's just something so transporting about reading a book that is just for fun. It's not educating you. It may be making you dumber, but it feels really, really good.
That segues perfectly into my chatter, which is very similar. I have also had that transporting experience with a particular book that I'm going to recommend, called Piranesi by Susanna Clarke, who wrote the Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell book. And Piranesi it's a very short book. It creates a fantasy universe that is so memorable and beautiful and weird. And I'm not going to say much about it, because to say much about it would be to kind of give away the pleasure that you would feel. But just know that it will bring you into a world that is so surprising, and a way of thinking that's so surprising. And I feel like Susanna Clarke must be the most interesting person there is. Her mind, I would like to live in it, because the permeable border in her mind between what is real and what is magical, It's for me, that's a hard border. That is a gigantic 200-mile high wall. But for her, it is the it's a cloud. She is moving back and forth between the magical and the real in this way that is amazing and beautiful, beautiful. So that book. But I also want to just mention one other book, which I've also been reading this summer, called Testament of Youth, which is a World War I memoir by a woman named Vera Brittain, who was a nurse in World War I, a young nurse. And it's about her experience as a nurse and her disillusionment. But what was stunning about this book is, here's this woman. She's an educated young woman of the early 20th century. And she has a boyfriend. She has a man she is attached to, later fiance, a World War I soldier. And she has all their correspondence in the book. And it really puts to shame us, because they cite poetry, they send poetry back and forth to each other. They have a perfect quote for any moment. You know, they're always citing this thing from Cicero, this thing from John Donne, this from, you know, this the new poet they've all been reading. And I just the level of sophistication and education and intense focus on literature and beauty is profound. And I definitely was not like that as a 19-year-old. So I don't know what's happened to all of us. Listeners, you also have cocktail chatters, probably, I hope, fantasy novels. Please keep them coming to us. Tweet them to us at @SlateGabFest or email them to us at gabfest@slate.com. And today's listener chatter comes to us from Mohammed El Sheikh.
My chatter this week is about an article in The Atlantic titled "Everyone Loses on Jeopardy Eventually" by a Pittsburgh-based writer and recent Jeopardy contestant, Adriana Ramirez. Mrs. Ramirez talks about her love of trivia and her experience making it onto the ultimate trivia show, Jeopardy, where she eventually ends up losing, and losing badly, to Ryan Long, the rideshare driver from Philadelphia. After agonizing about attending a watch party in a local bar in Pittsburgh, organized by her husband, she ends up reflecting on the amazing accomplishment of just getting on the show. In 2021, 99.6% of potential contestants didn't make it on the show. By comparison, Harvard rejected about 96.6% of applicants that same year. As a society, we put so much stock and value on winning that we sometimes fail to realize that even when we lose, we actually win.
That is our show for today. The Gabfest is produced by Shana Roth. Our researcher is Bridget Dunlap. Our theme music is by They Might Be Giants. Ben Richmond is Senior Director for Podcast Operations. And Alicia Montgomery is the VP of Audio for Slate. Follow us on Twitter at @SlateGabFest. Tweet chatter to us there. For Heather McGee, yay, Heather, and Emily Bazelon, I'm David Plotz. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week. Hello, Slate Plus. How are you? How have you been? Heather, you wrote a great book that we talked about on the Gabfest some months ago, a year ago, The Sum of Us, about how racism hurts everyone, even the racists, more than we realize. You're now doing a podcast inspired by the book, same title, The Sum of Us. It is out. Listen to it. Subscribe to it. And you have spent, as you mentioned a few minutes ago, you've spent a ton of time traveling around the U.S., apparently the last person finding hope in our highways and byways. So talk to us about the premise of The Sum of Us, the podcast.
The Sum of Us, the book, was about my journey across the country to try to answer the question, why is it that we can't seem to have nice things? Not like hovercraft backpacks, but like universal childcare and healthcare and paid family leave and great infrastructure and all of that. And what I found, as you said, is that racism in our politics and our policymaking has, you know, broken our capacity for collective action and big problem solving together.
That was just a snippet from our Slate Plus conversation. If you want to hear the whole conversation, go to slate.com/gabfestplus to become a member today.